Welcome back to Palestine Exists, the podcast where we explore the layered realities of Palestinian life, resistance, and identity under settler colonialism. Today's episode is a dense one, legally, politically, and existentially, because we're unpacking the role of UN resolutions in the Palestinian struggle and how their systematic dismissal by Israel is not just political posturing, but a tactic of impunity baked into the colonial structure itself. We're going to be talking about international law, not as a neutral field, but as a battleground. What does it mean when a state built on dispossession is also shielded from accountability by the very institutions that claim to uphold justice? What does it mean when dozens of Security Council resolutions, including binding ones, are openly violated with no consequences? And what does it mean for Palestinians who are not given full statehood in that system when law is used to manage them but not protect them? What happens when legal asymmetry mirrors the material asymmetry of occupation itself? So today you'll notice that something's a little different about the intro. Our beloved Petra is unfortunately feeling a little ill today. So hi, it's Hiba.
Salamat.
I know, salamat alaikum.
Salamat to my baby Petra.
I took over the kind of intro for today. I hope I did her justice. But
you did a great job. Absolutely amazing.
Thank you, Lina. So this is Hiba. And as always, we have our amazing co-host, Lina. Hi, Lanoush.
Hi, guys. Hi, Habuba. Oh, my God. Guys, I'm so excited for this episode. You guys don't understand.
Girl, this is your shit.
This is my favorite thing to, like, talk about a lot of times. Like, just the UN and, you know, the fact that Israel doesn't like to follow it, you know?
Mm-hmm. So let me, like, do a little bit. So, like, this episode isn't about, like, legal technicalities, mm-hmm. or, like, legalese, right? Mm-hmm. It's about power, language, and the global normalization of selective accountability, and about how international law has been bent to manage Palestine, not to liberate it. Mm-hmm. It's about how Palestinians are held to the law as humanitarian subjects, while Israel is allowed to weaponize its sovereignty to defy it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's important because international law remembers Palestine, but only briefly, only when it's politically convenient, only when it's symbolic. And just then, as quickly as it remembers it, it forgets it. So let's get into it.
Oh my gosh. So you guys might be wondering, like,
I'm wondering. I'm definitely wondering.
Oh my God. Okay, good, good. I'm glad, okay. I'm glad that you guys are wondering. So basically, you might be wondering what the UN even is. And, you know, we're going to quickly just go over that and, like, what its role as a, you know, international institution, organization, what is it supposed to do? So the United Nations, as we may or may not know, was founded in 1945, right after World War II, which is kind of ironic, I think, considering, you know, the state that is said to protect the Jews and be there for the Jews is the reason why this entire organization exists, and yet they ignore it so much. But regardless, its main goal as the UN is it's meant to just promote peace, security, cooperation between the countries. It currently has 193 member states, and that's usually how we decide if a country is a state, is if they're a member state of the UN. Now, basically, its job is to, you know, do those things, you know, enforce the law, enforce human rights, not necessarily enforce it, but, you know,
kind of upkeep it.
Upkeep it, you know, just make it clear that, hey, these things are wrong, don't defy them, kind of thing. Conflict resolution, all those great things. So the two main bodies of the UN that we're going to discuss today is the UN Security Council and the UN General Assembly. We're going to just quickly, briefly right here, just explain the difference between the two. So when we're focusing on UN Security Councils, which are basically enforceable, they are legally binding, and they are something that all states are recommended to follow, right? So in the case of UN resolutions that are passed under the UN Security Council, we're essentially expected to uphold them. As people who are a part of the state, we are expected to uphold them, we are expected to abide by them, and, you know, when they are passed, we should follow them, kind of thing. In the case of a General Assembly, while I will argue that they are just as important, they are not as important in the eyes of Israel. So basically, the UN operates through various bodies, and the two most important are, especially to this conversation, is basically the UN General Assembly and UN Security Council. And I'm basically just going to quickly discuss the differences between the two, just so that you guys can, you know, understand that this conversation and what we're talking about. So the General Assembly. So these are basically described as UN's parliament. Okay, so there are 193 member states, and they gather together to discuss the global issues. And as you can tell, in the case of Palestine, there has been countless resolutions passed at the General mm-hmm. Assembly level. And basically, we have each member state who gets a vote, and the decisions are usually made by 2/3 of a majority. So there has to be a majority in that regard.
Yeah, 109, like 2/3 of 193. Yeah. I'm not a math person, but y'all can figure it out.
Y'all do the math, because I can't anyways.
I won't.
But essentially, so then what happens is the General Assembly will then adopt a resolution based off of 2/3 of the majority. And, you know, then they are just expected to be upheld. Now, the reason why I find them to be very important, despite the fact that they're not necessarily legally binding, but it does show what the world's parliament, if you will, agree on in terms of a issue. So, for example, in the case of Palestine, we have countless General Assembly resolutions, which Israel continuously disregards as important. They'll be like, oh, they're not legally binding, they're not really that important. But I'd argue that they are, because it shows how majority of the time the world will say that this is something that is wrong and Israel should fix it, right? So one example of a General Assembly resolution is UN Resolution 194, which does guarantee the Palestinians their right to return. And this was passed in 1949 with the development of Israel as a state. And till this day, Israel still refused to enforce it because it's not necessarily legally binding. Now, this kind of brings me into the second part, which is UN Security Councils. So these ones are the legally binding ones, which also Israel tends to disregard, but you know, that's neither here nor there. Mm-hmm. So
we'll get into that. I'm gonna yap y'all's ears off.
We're
don't
gonna
worry.
Freaking yap. Okay, so the UN Security Councils, they are regarded as more powerful, which is true, in terms of enforcement, right? Because they are legally binding. And it basically has 15 members, and we always hear about the 5 permanent members. So the 5 permanent members are US, Russia, China, and France, and the UK. And basically, they have the power to veto any UN Security Council resolution where, you know, if they don't agree with it, which you'll often hear people talk in the case of Palestine, oh, Israel always has the US's veto power. We talked about it in one of our earlier episodes, so we won't really go deep into that. So mm-hmm. unlike the General Assembly, Security Council resolutions are legally binding, but only if passed under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which is what most people argue. This is what Israel argues. It's not necessarily the case. UN Security Council resolutions are legally binding because that is what all the states who signed on to it agreed to, right? UN Security Council resolutions always carry binding legal force. So under Article 25 of the Charter, which Israel is a part of, right? They are obliged mm-hmm. to accept and carry out all Security Council resolutions. This includes resolutions adopted under Chapter 5 or Chapter 7. So we're going to get deeper into this topic when we start discussing UN Resolution 242. But this is just a quick little preamble on the different bodies.
No, thank you for that, because it's important to know. But yeah, keep going. Sorry.
No, there's just one last thing that I wanted to read. So under Article 25 and what it means to be a part of the UN, like UN, and what it means to have a decision regarding UN's security councils. So basically, this is what I want to read out, and this is kind of the basis of most of the things that we're going to say today. The members of the United Nations agree to accept and carry out decisions of the Security Council in accordance with their present charter. So this applies mm-hmm. to all member states, including Israel. So I'm going to mm-hmm. hand the baton right back to Habuba.
Thank you. I'm going to be talking specifically about a little bit before we get into, you know, talk about you like before we deep dive into UN Resolution 242, I just want to talk specifically about like legal ontology and how just legally within like is it through the international world, through the international international law bodies, how they've always kind of viewed or recognized Palestine as a problem and not as a people. The UN has like a selective recognition, I guess, of Palestinian existence. So by that I mean essentially, so we have like from the outset, right, like the international legal system has treated Palestinians not as a nation, not as a people with rights, but as a problem, right? The Palestinian problem or the refugee mm-hmm. problem. And I'm sure like our cousins mm-hmm. Can understand, you know, and recognize like the Jewish question or the Jewish problem, right? Mm-hmm. We've been virtually treated the same way for the last 77 years of our existence. And like this isn't like just like political sidelining, right? It's ontological erasure. It's embedded into the grammar of like the post World War II legal order, right? So like, I don't know, I think it's like really important. Yeah. It's not this law, this like this system, right, with the, you know, modern international law or modern international legal system, it's built on state sovereignty. Mm-hmm. It's built on decolonization on imperial terms, and you know, as well as like Cold War bipolarity, right? There's like mm-hmm. specific instances of this, but I'm not
it's like the idea
that,
like
the ideal of like what a state mm-hmm. should be. It's not designed right. for stateless or colonized people.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, like they're not ever going to be viewed as like full political subjects. So yeah. When the UN, like you just mentioned it briefly, like when the UN passed Resolution 181, that's why basically it gave 55% right. of the land to the Jewish population, even right. though they made what, 30% of the population and had 6% yeah. like ownership of the land. Our ownership, I put that in like quotation marks, and then yeah. and they only gave 45% to the Arab Palestinian majority, right, mm-hmm. with no mechanisms of enforcement, no protection, nothing. Yeah. And then it moved on.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to your argument, like, oh, they at the time, Jewish people were treated as a problem. So it's
right.
like, it kind of goes
and,
right back
but
to
then,
that.
Yeah, and so then it then moved on, right? So like, okay, fine. Like, not for like whatever, partition plan was not, it was not implemented. So right. then, you know, Israel established itself as a state. And then
regardless
after all,
that,
you'd think,
yeah.
right, you'd think that, okay, fine. Like maybe then the next legal standard would to be like the populations that are living in that country, we should give them a protected status, or we should maybe right. like maybe attribute maybe just them as a people. Nope.
Yeah.
Palestinians were not named as a people then. And yeah. if we were like referenced at all, it mm-hmm. was only as the non-Jewish inhabitants.
Right.
This is like the epistemic root of legal erasure, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you cannot have rights if you're not even named as a subject.
Right.
Which is, like, extremely important.
Which is something we talked about in one of the previous episodes, too, right? Like, how in order to, you know, give Palestinians rights against genocide, right, they needed to first mm-hmm. be established as a people. And this was, like, very fairly recently.
Right. And I talked about this specifically about how were mentioned just like legally speaking. I'm gonna get into it in a bit after we're mm-hmm. done talking about 242, but about how Palestinians are just ghosts, we're virtually mm-hmm. non-existent, or if we're, you know, I'll talk more about it, but I just kind of wanted to like just do this like briefer yeah. about it. But I think it's important now that we talk about what Resolution 242 is, because it's like, and like, correct me if I'm wrong, Celine, right, Lena, for the record, she goes by a different name on TikTok where we like debate or whatever, so yeah. like she messes us up, like she knows this girl's doing psychological
guys,
warfare
I have,
on
like,
me
two different like guys it's actually
let's not
hilarious.
Bring up Ashley
oh god
anyway
guys I think the funniest thing on TikTok if you guys don't I mean I think most of our viewers are from TikTok, but if you're not, like, please follow us on there, because we do some funny stuff.
She's hilarious. Yeah. Maybe we can try to figure out, like, put our like ats in our like
put the ats in there. Okay, period.
Yeah. Okay. But I think, so correct me if I'm wrong, Lena, like the UN like Security Council resolutions when it comes to Palestine, it's 242, right? And then it's also 338, but that is reaffirming 242.
Right. So 338.
Right? Is there any, yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please talk to us about all of this, all the Security Council resolutions, specifically about 242, please.
Yes, Pookie. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about like UN General Assemblies, there was a lot of those. There was like over 100 UN General Assembly resolutions passed in the case of Palestine. So in the case of Palestine and Israel, and things that were just expected of Israel to follow. And you'll often hear from like these like Zionists and people who are just pro-genocide. They'll be like, oh, the world is just singling us out. The UN is singling us out.
Oh, yeah. What is their argument? Like, oh, there's more sanctions or there's more
UN resolutions
against.
Oh, God. It's so funny because they're all passed under the General Assembly, right? Which are basically just resolutions passed by other states. Yeah.
Yeah. We all the other states don't really hold virtually any weight.
What's that part? Yes, but it's like also the fact that it's not necessarily passed by the UN. It's not the UN who's deciding. It's like all of the other states voting. Who voted.
Like, yeah,
exactly. All the other states agree that hey,
it's like,
Israel,
it's like
you are
in class, like, oh, you're in trouble. Like,
yes, yes. Like we all agree that you're in a state of belligerency, for example, which a lot of times General Assembly resolutions do agree with that. Hey, Israel, you shouldn't kick people out of their land and then just not let them back in. Those ones are all passed under a General Assembly. Now, the reason why we focus on the Security Council a little bit more is because they are considered legally binding. And in this case, we're talking about UN Resolution 242. And this was basically after the 67 war, where Israel occupied like five different territories. It decided to occupy, it took occupation over the Golan Heights and the Sinai, which are Syrian and Egyptian territory. And it also took occupation over the Gaza Strip, took occupation of West Bank, East Jerusalem. So five different territories that are not its, right? They didn't belong to them.
Not theirs, yeah.
Not its. Oh my God, it's crazy. Not
You're
theirs.
So funny.
It took control over these areas. And this one was kind of agreed upon by the entire world that, hey, you're not allowed to do that, right? You're not allowed to just go into regions and acquire land because we passed a law a couple years prior, right? Saying that you cannot acquire land through, land acquisition is illegal. So there was this resolution, UN Resolution 242, which stated, hey, all territories do not have the right to acquire land, even in like the case of Israel, even if you are trying to argue that it's a defensive war, which it's not, by the way, but that is their argument. There is no legality in taking land and declaring it as yours, right? Occupying land in this manner is illegal. So they passed the UN Resolution 242, and Israel denied it. It said, we're not going to abide by this. We do not agree with this resolution. And basically, since 1967 has refused to abide by this resolution. And you'll often hear from Palestinians like, hey, we are occupied. We are occupied and we want to have our own sovereignty. We want to be able to live inside of our land freely, equally, all of these things. And Israel to this day refuses to abide by it. And which brings up our point about like, oh, like if a state is allowed to just defy international law, even the legally binding resolutions, why can they get away with that, like, without any impunity, right? Like, there has never been sanctions on the case of Israel. Like, they've never been sanctioned for this belligerent occupation, which is classified
right.
as
and
illegal.
Like, this is one of my arguments when I talk about them. They're like, fine, the UN is, like, what, anti-Semitic? But, like, what happens in situations where there's been member states who have violated Security Council resolutions? What happens then? And they're like, they're sanctioned.
They're flabbergasted.
Or they're threatened sanctioned. They're always like these countries are always sanctioned or threatened sanctions. Like, what happened to Russia? Just Russia alone should stand still, like, with what happens to them or what happened with, like, Turkey and the journalist. They were sanctioned. They were cut off until they remedied the issue or rectified the issue, where Israel's never been threatened sanctions. Israel's never been actually sanctioned. And I just think that's important. So you guys can like cry as much as you want about how there's so many like resolutions against you, but what has the world actually done about
No one's done anything about it, right? Like it's it's kind of funny. But the other thing is, right, like whenever we're talking to Zionists or whenever you hear like the Zionist arguments as to why they don't have to abide by international law, you'll often hear like that little preamble before they do it. They'll be like, oh, we don't care about international law. Oh, we don't care about the UN. We don't care about these things, which is kind of funny, which like, you know, it is funny when they do that, because it's like you literally argue that your entire existence, your entire statehood comes from UN, a UN resolution passed in 1947. Like that's usually their argument. But it's funny whenever they say like, we don't care about international law, because then it's kind of like, okay, well, what do you care about, right? Which we know they do believe that they are above international law. So before they do that, before they go into defending why they are allowed to do that, they always make it clear like, hey, we do not care about international law. We do not care about the UN. However, this is why we are in accordance with it. It's so funny. It's so funny when they do that. But anyways, so in the case of UN Resolution 242, you'll often hear them arguing that it's not legally binding because it wasn't passed under the Article 5, as I brought up earlier. Or sorry, Article 7, as I brought up earlier. And instead it was passed under Article 6. Now, the reason why that is just a ridiculous claim to make is because, as we discussed, under Article 25 of the UN, all members are like bound by UN Security Councils. They are meant to be followed. So that's just to like make it clear to anyone listening that if you do ever hear that argument, it's not valid, right? Like it's not a smart thing to say, because they are legally binding. You are expected to uphold them. However, the other big thing here is that in the case of Israel, like in this specific UN resolution, it basically makes it clear that it's not like a recommendation or anything. It's just upholding this specific law, emphasizing the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war and the need to work for a just and lasting peace in every state in the area where they can live in security. So this is what the UN Resolution 242 states specifically, that you cannot acquire territory by war. And this isn't something that was, this wasn't a law that was made. It was a law that is followed under the UN. So basically, the main point here is that it's been 56 years and Israel has yet to withdraw from illegally occupied territory till this day, right? And in the case of East Jerusalem, it's actually illegally annexed it, which brings us into the second UN Security Council that was passed, which is UN Resolution 2334, I believe, right? Is it 2334? Give me just a second.
Yeah, 2016.
Right. 2016.
Well, yeah, I believe, wasn't there the, I believe that there was a couple between like from like the 70s to the 80s, there was resolution like 338, which we briefly mentioned, as well as resolution like 446 that talks about the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories as illegal, right, under the Fourth Geneva Convention. Then there was resolution 465 and passed in 1980 that like, you know, told them to dismantle the existing like settlements and to cease constructions of new ones. And then there was resolution 476 and 478 that both speak to Jerusalem. And they says that like basically declared like all Israeli actions altering the status of Jerusalem as a null and void. And then resolution 497, because I'm like pulling it up in my notes. So and resolution 497 was the Israeli 1981, which was when it was passed, and it rejected Israeli annexation of the Golan Heights. And then 1322, which was passed in 2000, which condemned Ariel Sharon's provocation of Al-Aqsa, like at Al-Aqsa compound, and it affirmed Jerusalem's status must be resolved through negotiations. And then we have the 2334 one.
Exactly. Yeah. So like the biggest thing to note here is that, okay, so It's been 56 years since, or 57 now, yeah. It's been since 1967 where Israel has been illegally occupying all these territories and has actually taken it a step further to try to declare sovereignty over East Jerusalem. And it has done that. Thankfully, it's not recognized by the UN as Israeli territory. It is, they had to do another resolution to make it clear, hey, like, your presence inside of East Jerusalem is illegal. We do not recognize it. And still nothing was done, right? The UN didn't really do anything to change it other than make all these resolutions. It's kind of like, I don't know. I don't want to call it unimportant, because it does at least recognize that there is a law and Israel is in defiance of it. But
mm-hmm.
It's not really doing anything about it, right? And I think Habuba's going to go right into this this part. Yeah.
100%. Before I get into that, I want to talk about why it's important, because so many people are like, oh, well, then did Hamas violate, like, the Security Council resolution
Or
did Hamas? Like, there's... okay.
There are arguments. So let's talk... oh, okay, I can't wait for this. So I'm listening, Pookie.
So, okay, Vivi. So,
yeah, she does this part so well, by the way, because, like, most people don't really even touch on this point.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad that she's bringing this up. Yeah.
Thank you. I freaking love you. Okay. So let's talk about how, judicial subjectivity, sovereignty, as well as, like, legal ontology, right? So basically, there's Israel, we understand, is a full UN member since 1949, as you said, right? It's bound by, like, when we talk about bound by, that means they have signed, like, these documents that hold them liable or legally liable to them if they were to violate any of these laws or violate, like, any of the resolutions put forth, right? Like, they are bound to it. It's like a contract that they sign.
Mm-hmm.
So they're bound by the UN Charter, Security Council resolutions, Geneva Conventions, the Rome Statute, which is, like, the UNSC, and numerous bilateral and multilateral treaties, right? As well as it's obligated under international humanitarian law, laws of occupation, and customary international law because of the situations that arose, right? Israel is not only bound, it is structurally protected in its violations. Vetoes, which we talked about, right? And like Lena just talked about a little bit briefly, but particularly the United States vetoes have shielded it from enforcement, even under chapter 6 or chapter 7? Bad with Roman numerals.
Chapter
VII.
Seven, yep, chapter 7.
Yeah, yep. And so when you look at, for example, the Palestinian Authority, right? It's a non-member state. It's ratified over 100 international treaties, including the Geneva Convention and the Rome Statute, but it's not bound by UNSC resolutions per se, but it's chosen to act within legal frameworks, including submitting cases to the ICC and ICJ. If you like look back to like the Wall case of 2004, that they had a big part to play in that. But like I said, they don't have to. The PA doesn't have to, you know, abide by the like UNSC or like international humanitarian law, but mm-hmm. they still do because they're good boys. They're not like, you know.
Okay, I'm actually PA, rolling.
Regardless.
All the PA.
But then we have Hamas, right? Like, which is a political opposite, where they are a non-state armed actor under occupation. Right?
Mm-hmm.
One more time. A non-state armed actor under occupation. They're not a party to any UN or state level treaty framework. They're obligated, sure, under Common Article 3, I believe, of the Geneva Conventions,
mm-hmm.
which is like protections of civilians and treatment of prisoners. But regardless, the colonial violence that here, like, it, you can see here, right? The colonial violence, you can see the inversion of responsibility. Israel, the sovereign occupier with legal obligations, is protected, whereas Palestinians, the occupied people, are disciplined, surveilled, and held to humanitarian standards as if they were sovereign aggressors. It's
mm-hmm.
and it's like not to be confused. Like, this isn't like legal confusion. This isn't something like, oh, maybe it's too, you know, it's like too complicated. No. It's containment. This is essentially what it is. It's legal containment of the Palestinian people. And so I think it's just like extremely important to talk about this, right? Like I said, the Palestinian people, as we've been non existent, like I said, and I'll get into it briefly in a second. I mean, not briefly, but in a second, about how we're just non-existent. They mm-hmm. assume that we are should be like they assume that there is like a moral equivalency or even like a legal equivalency mm-hmm. when it comes to like the actions of a state versus the actions of the people that that state occupies. Like there's right. there's no equivalence to be drawn there.
Absolutely not. Yeah. It's so interesting when you see them do that, though, right? And they do it a lot in the case of like specifically UN Resolution 242, which we brought up earlier. They'll be like, oh, mm-hmm. but the Palestinians aren't like they aren't the ones. They aren't even agreeing to it. And it's like, first of all, they have like you're wrong there. But
right,
like they're not the ones that are that like they're the ones who are lacking these basic human rights. Israelis do not lack their human rights, right? And in the case of the UN, which is meant to uphold basic human rights, yeah, like the Palestinians' only job is to gain those rights. They don't have to concede to you know, Israel acquiring land illegally. That's not something that they have to do under international law. It's not something that they're even expected to do necessarily.
Right.
As much as international law will try to sit here and like promote things that aren't fair for the Palestinians, we aren't obliged to like answer them. We aren't obliged to accept them, right? Despite the fact on numerous occasions, I mean, Hiba brought up the PA earlier, they have accepted these things out of pure like they are just, they have been worked to the end and they see no hope in sight. It's almost like a defeatism point where they have accepted mm-hmm. these things. But yeah, like we aren't bound by international law the same way that Israel is, or you know, I know it was gonna go into this, but yes.
Yeah, but like even when like Hamas, right, like and even the PLO before Oslo, right? It exists in a legal vacuum of non-recognition. Mm-hmm. We're treated as a threat, not a subject. The international system, including the UN, they're designed to deal with states, right? And when it deals with non-state actors, it does so with the prism of like terrorism or like quote unquote armed groups, right? And it's not, they're never viewed as liberation movements or national authorities. The dynamic is ontological, which is Israel's presumed legal even when it violates the law, and Hamas is presumed illegal even when it resists under law that's granted to them, mm-hmm. right? And this is like what we, this is like very, very, this is very, very like common, or this is a common practice under settler colonialism or like the settler colonial judicial order. The law is not a field of equality. It's a structure that like reifies sovereign and mm-hmm. like sovereign dominance and pathologizes resistance. And it's not like, and Hamas is not immune from legal critique. But to center Hamas's violations in the same breath as Israel's, to continue to conflate like colonial domination with resistance to it, it's not legal. It's colonial,
mm-hmm.
right? The yeah. conflation isn't legal. It's colonial, and right. So like we'll talk more about like the strategic. Now we're gonna get into like, the next kind of segment where we talk about. I want to talk about like Palestinian non-existence, basically. I just like. If you guys briefly remember when I talked about the, you know, post, you know, like the 1947 partition plan, when, you know, how we were viewed as like not really as people, we were only viewed as the non-Jewish inhabitants of that land. And we see it like, you know, with the fact that in 47, with Resolution 181, they offered, or they, you know, when they wanted to partition it, they offered 55% of land to the Jewish population, who made up 30% of the population and owned less than 6% of the land, where you see only 45% was allocated to the like Palestinian majority, who owned majority of the land, but they didn't offer any like actual mechanisms of enforcement or protection. So mm-hmm. after that, I'm gonna get into like a yap sesh real quick, but I want to talk about how. After that, we were viewed as humanitarian subjects and not legal agents. So from 48 onward, right, international institutions treated Palestinians primarily through the lens of like refugeedom. So we became the largest or the world's longest standing refugee population, not citizens, not like a polity, not as a people, not a nation in exile. We became a refugee population. That's essentially what we were reduced to. We even saw this when UNRWA, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, was codified in 1949. UNRWA addressed welfare, aid, humanitarian relief. It does not address political status, sovereignty, or return, while UNHCR, the High Commission for Refugees, was barred from dealing with Palestinian refugees. Mind you, how many, like, you know this, Lena, right? Like, how many refugees does the UNHCR deal with, or HCR deal with?
It's like
globally, like a
billion? A lot more. Yeah, yeah.
Like a long, like, yeah, a lot a, more than
no, no, and I think it's like
I don't know if it's a billion, it, but it's 20, a really big it, number.
It's like 22 million. Like, it's like a pretty big number.
A large number, right? And they're, it's fine. It's not that important, but just, yeah. I just want to show the contrast where this body who's you know, supposed to deal with refugees from, like, from any country, they're dealing with Ukrainian refugees or Syrian refugees or whatever refugee, and they're barred from dealing with the Palestinian refugees. So it placed the Palestinian refugee outside the global refugee regime, right?
Right.
And what this meant was that the Palestinians were systematically depoliticized in law, right? We became beneficiaries of aid, not subjects of rights. We became objects of negotiation, not participants in statecraft. And we also then became managed populations, not legal persons in the full sense. Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so to this day, the legal status of Palestinians remains fragmented. And this is done systematically, right? Like, some are citizens under occupation, where we see, like, people living in the West Bank or in Gaza. Some are residents without citizenship in East Jerusalem. Some are stateless exiles. We have the refugee camps or the people or the Palestinians living in Lebanon, Syria, or Jordan. Some are refugees with conditional nationality. Like, this is where you see most of us diaspora Palestinians. And then you see some as citizens of Israel, but were excluded from their national identity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No other people in the world have been so systematically unrecognized in law while being hyper-visible in crisis. Like, think about that for a sec.
No, that was a really good way to put it.
Yeah, like, we're always viewed at the forefront. Oh, right. Look at what's happening to the Palestinians. Look at the world. Look at what's happening. But we're so unrecognized. And I talk about it, if you guys, like, refer back to the genocide episode where I talk about how we were basically ghosts. We had no legal status. And like I said earlier, we've only ever existed as a problem and not a people, or something to be fixed or something to deal with and not as a people.
Right.
It's just a
sad reality. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's, like, talk about, I'm going to briefly get into, like, the strategic, like the rejection or the strategic dismissal of the UN by Zionists, right?
Right, yeah.
And how Zionist leaders have always had, like, a paradoxical relationship with international law, right? They embraced it with, you know, the partition plan. They always, so like, funny. Oh, yeah, we accepted the 19, whatever the fuck.
The French accent, bro.
Oh, it's so nasty. Sorry. It's trigger so warning. Funny.
We accepted it. You guys didn't. Okay.
Buddy. Like, yeah. And it's like, so you're going to, you know, welcome it. We're going to embrace it with open arms when it suited your goals. But the moment that the UN imposes limits, the moment it condemns settlements or annexation or military occupation, the UN becomes irrelevant.
Anti-Semitic. It's so funny. It's so freaking funny because, like, in the case of UN Resolution 181, which was, like, the 47 Partition Plan, it wasn't enforcing international law. It wasn't saying, like, hey, you have to do this because international law says so. It's like, hey, we recommend this to be a good solution. What do you guys think, right? Nobody had to accept it. Not the Jews, not the Palestinians. But in the case of like, most of the resolutions passed against Israel right now, that they are claiming are anti-Semitic, they are codified in law. Like, they are spoken, they are written in order to protect people's basic human rights, right? The right to self-determination, the right to return. All these things are, like, basic principles under law. The law against land acquisition, right? It's not anti-Semitic to say, hey, Israel, you're in defiance of this law that, which, by the way, you signed on to it. You begged to be a part of the UN.
No, like, no one forced you to sign these laws.
No,
like,
one forced King, you.
But, like, you did it on your own. Like,
right. Which is just so funny, too, because like when they were accepted to the UN, right? When they signed those agreements to be a part of the UN and they were offered to be a part of the UN and all these things, right? Which is something that they wanted, right? They didn't have to. They could have just remained, you know, not recognized by the rest of the world. That's totally fine. They wanted to be a part of the UN. The UN did expect them to enforce UN Resolution 194, which I brought up earlier. It was a General Assembly. It was a recommendation. But it was like, hey, you can't kick out people and then leave them as refugees. Allow them to return, right? It was the right of return for Palestinians. And basically, when they were accepted to the UN, the UN had a stipulation of like, hey, you guys should abide by this resolution, just as a by the way. And they didn't. And
by the way, like you guys, like you, you guys kind of signed up for this.
You signed up for this, right? Like this is something that is like comes along with being a member of the UN, right? Like, you know, right your wrongs, you know, uphold international law. And they ignored it. They ignored abiding by UN Resolution 181 in 1949 when they were accepted once again. 181 was that partition plan because, as we know, Israel breached that partition plan. It took beyond more than what it was given. It took about 80% of the land rather than the 53 that they were, you know, quote unquote given, right? They didn't have to.
Because they declared independence, yeah.
Right. They and like, declared independence over it, yeah.
Yeah. And this is an inconsistency, right? It's a doctrine of legal exceptionalism, right? Mm-hmm. Israel refuses to be bound by the same laws that they swore and pledged that they would adhere to. So Golda Meir, she once said, right, we say to the UN, you are irrelevant. And mm-hmm. I can pull up the countless of tweets that we saw from Bibi or from like the president or like from these like, you know, government actors of Israel after the ICJ decided to take on the genocide case like last year or the last 2 years. We saw them saying that it's irrelevant. We don't care. No one will stop us. No IHL, which is international humanitarian law, can stop us. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. They've said this. And like something I was taught is when someone says something, you believe them. Mm-hmm. And so this irrelevance only applies when the UN remembers Palestine or Palestinians, not when it affirms Israeli claims. It's legal opportunism, right? Or legal warfare. It's the settler regimes, usually they invoke law to validate their origin, and then they cast aside international law they cast aside law to maintain their settler expansion, right? It's legal. It's like legal colonialism. And like, you know, as like Noura Erekat like famously said, she says, law is politics by other means, right? Mm-hmm. Which is so important when we talk about this. It's just so frustrating.
And you know what's funny about that, Hiba, actually? You know, for the longest time, I mean, as long as, you know, Golda Meir was what, president, what was it, like 50-ish years ago? Like, it's been a while. For a very long time, Israel has, like, maintained that, you know, we do not necessarily care about international law. But finally, in 2025, right, after the genocide case, it's actually decided to withdraw from the UN Human Rights Council. Like it said, like, hey, we don't even want to be a part of it. You guys are anti-Semitic for expecting us to uphold human rights, right? Like it basically is, it left. It finally decided to just leave, which I think is actually good riddance. I'm actually glad that they decided to leave because at least you're not pretending to be signed on to something that you don't care about. But for this entire time, I mean, all these resolutions that we're talking about were passed, what? Within those 76 years of them existing. So
77.
I keep forgetting. Yeah. Y'all, we're in 2025. That's crazy.
Like,
yeah. But it's funny.
Like, even like, you can see this even with, like, Ben-Gurion, right? So there was, like, a debate in the Knesset. Where like the opposition was saying like, hey, you know, like, yo, we should probably respect the UN since they, you know, they kind of made us like they, you know, and like literally Ben Gurion said, shmoom. I'm not joking. Like, I'm not joking. Which means like the UN, like, yeah.
UN shmoom.
Like, huh? Like, he didn't care. Like, he dismissed it.
Of course, yeah. They got what they wanted out of it.
You see this as early as 49, 50, mm-hmm. right? To now, like, you see them, right. like, with the BB, quite literally tweeting it out like it's nothing, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And then let's now talk more about, like, what this means for Palestinians, right? And how essentially, right?
Like, what? It's been 76 years of them defying international law. And, you know, they always make it clear, like, hey, we don't even want to abide by international law. I don't know. I find it kind of funny. I find it, like,
right.
and at the end of the day, like, it's the, we know what it means for Palestinians. We know that it means mm-hmm. more pain and suffering. It means more basic human rights being violated. And for Israel, you know, they just get what they want. They're settler colonial expansionism. They get to genocide the Palestinians, right? They get to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians. They get all of the land to themselves. Like, I mean, it's clear as day.
And, like, we see the right, like, and I know we talked briefly about General Assembly resolutions, right? And, like, however, like, I still think it's important that, like, the fact that most of the world has agreed, right? Most mm-hmm. of these member states have all agreed to pass these laws, like, for example, affirming the right to our self-determination, mm-hmm. affirming our right to return, affirming our right for statehood. But, like, because these resolutions are simply non-binding, they're right. they're largely ignored and they're never enforced, right? But as Palestinians, we're only ever remembered as victims of war, right? Gaza, Jenin, Sabra, Shatila. We are always ever viewed as figures of humanitarian crisis. Mm-hmm. Or we're always viewed or we're always viewed as, like, a negotiating issue in the so-called peace process, right? We're never viewed as a people with a sovereign claim to the land. Mm-hmm. We're never viewed as people with, a sovereign claim to return or freedom from colonial rule. It's legalized dehumanization there's this legal theorist. His name is Henry. He calls it specifically colonial difference. So it's, you see the colonial difference in international law. We see the distinction between those who are subjects of law and those who are objects of the law's administration, right? And we, this is where we've continued to exist for the last 77 years.
Yeah.
When,
like,
Israel
in the middle. Yeah.
Yeah, like, we just like non-existence. It's mm-hmm. so fucked. And when you see when Israel violates these dozens of Security Council resolutions, right, like, it's not violating law. It's, like we said earlier, it's demonstrating that the law will never constrain settler power, mm-hmm. especially when that power is aligned with U.S. hegemony, like, hegemony. Oh my God, sorry. But the Palestinians, at the same time, were told, seek justice through the ICC. Yeah. To avoid violence, wait for negotiations, and also then condemn any resistance that is not state sanctioned.
Yeah, wait to negotiate with someone who makes it clear that, hey, you guys do not matter. The main negotiators of the world that I signed on to, you don't actually matter. And then we're expected to just seek our rights through them when there's no one upholding them. It's so funny. It's so weird.
And then, like, it's an impossible legal landscape. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, we're not sovereign, but we're expected to behave as if we are. Mm-hmm. We're colonized, but we must adhere to norms that are designed for states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're forgotten as a nation, but we're only remembered when our suffering becomes politically useful.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just that it's unfair, it's like absurd. It's absurdity, yeah. right? And
it's impossible thing to navigate, like, for the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And they've made that clear. Even Hamas, right? And we always see Hamas being, like, framed as this, like, you know, they don't want peace, they just want to unalive Jews, blah, 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 which is just so insane, right? Because even Hamas in 2005, in 2006, when they became, you know, the legal power in Gaza, they made it clear. They were like, hang on, like, you guys keep expecting all these things of us, but you have yet to get the expectation of Israel to uphold our rights until our rights to exist are met. We've already recognized your right to exist, and they referenced, you know, the PLO at the time, but you've yet to give us our rights. Why are we pretending to, like, basically say that, okay, if the Palestinians concede to more things, there will be peace? I mean, the Palestinians have done more than just concede. And Israel has done nothing. Israel hasn't even tried to negotiate anything with the Palestinians, despite whatever Israeli state actor, Israeli propagandists might tell you, oh, we offer all these resolutions, we give so many solutions. I mean, let's just start with the basic ones that you were expected to abide by when you were admitted as a state. How about we start with those, right? If we're really going to pretend that you guys are offering all these solutions, you can't even abide by basic international law. So, I mean, I don't know. I find it interesting. And yeah, it just brings us back to, like, we're expected to act as state actors, and
but not,
we get nothing out of it.
We're not, like, viewed, like, they're holding us to this, to the most impossible, like, standard that we'll never be able to meet because we're not state actors, right? And so we're almost done. So, like, I want to talk about what happens when like the law forgets us, like what remains, right? Like when law forgets, what remains? And when we say that, when, like, you know, as the title of the episode you guys will see, it says, like, you know, the law remembers Palestine until it doesn't, we're indicating that not only, like, we're indicating not only selective enforcement, but the deeper, like, epistemic violence of forgetting. International law forgets Palestine not through silence, but through performative memory, like resolutions that condemn without consequence, reports that document without justice. Palestine becomes a file in an archive of endless delays. And yet, as Palestinians, we always return to these archives. We file claims in the ICC. We testify at the ICJ. We cite laws in protest banners, and we invoke Geneva in Gaza. Why? Like, why do we do that? Because it's, law is essentially the last available language that still names the crime, right? Mm-hmm. Even in failure, it remains a form of archival resistance. It's proof that the colonizer was always seen, was always known, and it's always recorded. It's like as I mentioned, like, Noor Arakat earlier, another thing that she says is that this is exactly what Noor Arakat says when she, like, means when she says that international law is indeterminate, but it's usable, right? It's not going to save Palestine, but it can witness Palestine. And witnessing matters, I think. And to conclude, basically, that, like, international law does not reflect reality. It produces a reality. It names what's legitimate and what is sovereign. Like, what is a crime? What is resistance? And to be excluded from law is to be excluded from, like, political futurity, right? Like, the future, political future, like, having a political future. And to remembered only in pain is to be denied history, nationhood, justice, sovereignty, self-determination. And yet we continue, like I said, to invoke law. And it's not because we're naive. It's because recording
all we
matters.
Have left.
And
yeah.
And the world, we're going to be, you know, one day we're going to, like, look at the world and we're going to force them to, like, they're not going to be able to say, oh, we didn't know. We didn't know what was happening to you guys. No, because of this record, because of this archival, like I said earlier, this archival resistance, we're going to force them to say, we knew, but we chose to forget. And, you know, we force the law to remember us. This is why we, like I said, we continue to go to the ICC. We continue to be, you know, witnesses, and we continue to make our voices heard because we force the law to remember us and why it must be held accountable every fucking time it forgets. And to conclude, basically,
that was so well said, by the way. Like,
thank you.
Every single time it forgets, hey, we are still here. Yeah.
And last thing is that international law did not forget Palestine accidentally. It was designed to. But we, as Palestinians, like I said, we're going to continue to force it to remember. It's not because we trust the system or, like I said, because we're naive. It's because we refuse to be erased from its memory. Because even when the law forgets, Palestinians don't. And
That's exactly it. We have a right to exist. And actually, international law does agree with that. It does agree that people deserve basic human rights. I mean, yeah, we have every right to ask for those things. And we've been trying to do it for 76 years and still no end in sight. But, you know, we at least can reference something that all these states pretended to agree to. We can at least reference and be like, hey, you say that you agree with these rights, you signed on to them, and you're just not giving them to us. Why don't we deserve these rights? Why don't Palestinians deserve the right to exist the same way every single other human deserves the right to exist? And yeah, I think that's the purpose of international law in my eyes. I think it's there to remind them that you guys are all hypocrites. Like, I don't know.
Right. 100%. 100%. And and I think that it's important to continue, you know, we always say this, our existence is resistance. And no matter how we exist in the realm or the world of international law or the world of physical, you know, like violent resistance, it's important and it's measured the same that we are forcing the world to remember. And we demand, right? Like I said earlier, international law is not going to save us, but it was never built for us or to, you know, it was never meant to save us. It's, we're using it to speak, to record, to resist this erasure, we're demanding that even though the law is not protecting us, we're demanding it to at least remember us. And we'll keep reminding it because our lives, our names, our martyrs, and our histories are never, or we refuse to be forgotten. Mm-hmm. And with that, we've reached the end of today's episode. As always, we close by refusing erasure. Humanize Gaza was created to commemorate every one of our martyrs, whether in Gaza, the West Bank, or Lebanon, whose lives were taken in the struggle for liberation. It's not charity. It's just a memory. It's memory as resistance. We are not numbers, and it's grief that doesn't ask for permission. It's our refusal to let our dead be statistics. You can read more about our martyrs, or read our martyr stories by searching Humanize Gaza on Quora. And we're building towards a newsletter to archive these lives with the care and, you know, with the care that they deserve. So stay tuned for that. Today we are going to be remembering, Mahmoud Al-Madhoun. He was the Palestinian chef and the co-founder of Gaza Soup Kitchen. He ascended to martyrdom after being targeted and killed by an IOF drone. Over the course of the genocide, Mahmoud successfully fed over 3,000 people a day through his efforts with the Gaza Soup Kitchen. Al-Madhoun and his family opened the first soup kitchen in Beit Lahia in early 2024, and served traditional vegetable stews in order to combat Israel's deliberate and manufactured starvation of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who steadfastly chose to remain in the north of Gaza. The kitchen began with 4 pots and fed 120 families on the first day. And as it grew over the months, it eventually came to provide meals to thousands daily. As the operations manager of the kitchen, Al-Madhoun would personally forage seasonable vegetables himself, as well as work alongside local farmers, harvesting their crops under constant threat of IOF aggression. Without a doubt, Al-Madhoun's incredible success at combating hunger in an area actively besieged by the occupation is the reason why Israel targeted and killed him. In an article published in the Washington Post in April, Al-Madhoun wrote, "We hope that before these dwindling resources run out, President Biden steps up to prevent the imminent famine that the UN says a quarter of Gaza's population faces. Instead of sending more bombs to kill us with, until then, we will keep serving our community, remembering that when all else has failed the Palestinians, the land did not." who worked tirelessly and against all odds to feed our people for the past 14 months and counting. May the seeds he planted on our land among our people continue to bear the fruit beyond his martyrdom until and past the hour of Palestinians' liberation. Chef Mahmoud is survived by his brother, Hani, his wife, Ala, and their 7 children, and their youngest, who was 13 days old by the when like this was written. Allah yirhamo. And glory to all of our martyrs.
Hiba, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Did you pick this person like specifically for this topic? Because I don't know how it was possible, but it kind of showed exactly what we were talking about. How he mentioned like subhanAllah, that's why I said that. Like he literally mentioned
the world will forget, but we won't.
Yeah. And
the land, like the thing about he said about the land, it literally gave me
about the UN,
that.
About that too, but like about the UN and how he, you know, the UN.
I'll repeat it.
Yeah, that part right here. It's essentially like the hypocrisy that we're talking about.
Yeah, and how he said here, I'll repeat it. He says, this was an article in the Washington Post, but we hope that before these dwindling resources run out, President Biden steps up to prevent the imminent famine that the UN says a quarter of Gaza's population faces, instead of sending more bombs to kill us with. Until then, we will keep serving our community, remembering that when all else has failed the Palestinians, the land did not.
SubhanAllah. So like that, literally exactly what we were talking about how the UN continues to like, you know, it is there for us. It says that we have these rights. It says that we are facing a famine, and it's, you know, according to the body that you were all signed on to, America, you're signed on to this. Why are you not giving us the food that we deserve? Why are you upholding Israel's oppression?
The land remembers us. The land remembers who her people are.
100%.
And with that, please, you guys, thank you for listening. And we'll see you guys next week, inshallah.
Thank you, guys. So, thank you.
Eid Mubarak to everybody.
Yes, Eid Mubarak, everyone.
Is there like a Lent Mubarak? I don't know.
A Lent Mubarak, yeah.
Lent Mubarak to my Christians out there. All right, guys. Well, you know, like, subscribe, do all the things. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, bye, guys, for listening.
Bye, Habuba.
Bye. Feel better, Patura.
Feel better.